Good afternoon, everyone. So thank you for staying to hear about cranberries. We're going to shift gears not just for crop, but for some of the questions that we're asking about the crop. It's a little bit different because cranberries are grown in kind of confined regions. We've done a lot of nutrient work over the past 25 to 30 years. And these days, a lot of what we think about is more on the water quality side. So obviously, we want to support production in our fertility programs. We want to know how much fertility the plants need, what forms, when to apply, just like with these other berry crops. But we're also looking at preservation of the environment. And in Massachusetts, that's twofold. We're in a coastal area, so we're concerned about nitrogen in coastal waterways. And we are a crop that uses a lot of fresh water, so we do a lot of interacting with inland lakes where phosphorus is the issue. For those of you who aren't familiar with cranberries, this is a little bit about how it grows. The plant forms a fibrous root mat. It's a stoloniferous crop, similar to blueberries, so you have these horizontal stolons that would lay along the soil. The roots arise off of those. And then upright shoots also arise from the stolons, and it's the upright shoots that bear the fruit. And you'll notice the one with the fruit on it is starting to tip over a bit. The lower part of that is the previous year's growth. Those leaves will eventually fall away. That stem will rest on the ground, and now you have mats of stolons and these tipped over uprights along the ground, and cranberry growers apply layers of sand to anchor those down and encourage the production of more upright shoots. And so what you end up with in a mature cranberry bed are these layers of sand and root zones. Cranberries are a wetland plant. They are grown in either converted or created wetland settings for the most part. Certainly in Massachusetts that's the case. You can see the very rectangular beds are newer plantings that are probably a created wetland soil, and the more organic shapes are plantings that were put in following the contours generally of peat in the soil. As was mentioned way back at the beginning of the session, cranberries, like blueberries, have a much lower nutritional requirement, predominantly due to growing in acid soils. Much lower percentage of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium in the plant tissue compared to other crops. But as is the case with all of these berry crops, the percentages of nitrogen and potassium are quite higher than the percentage of phosphorus. So back in the dawn of cranberry time, when I was doing my PhD work, I actually did some work calculating how many pounds of the various nutrients would be removed in our cultural system between leaf removed as debris and what's removed in the berries when they're harvested. And again, you see, as is the case with the proportions of the nutrients in the plant, the removal follows that, with nitrogen and potassium being the most removed and phosphorus the least. And then beside that is just a list of some of the extension recommendations, showing again that cranberries and blueberries generally have a lower recommendation for annual nitrogen compared to some other crops. And we found that nitrogen is correlated with yield. So yes, as we add more nitrogen, we get more yield, but only up to a certain point. When we exceed a certain amount of added nitrogen, we start to see a decline in yield, but an increase in vegetative growth. So we shift the plant to a more vegetative habit. And in fact, we do find some correlations with applied nitrogen and yield, but in a study that was done by Joan Davenport and me, we found that the correlation with the previous year's application and the 2 years before application was actually had a stronger correlation coefficient than what's applied in the year of the crop. So this is a perennial, and there is a lot of carryover in the nitrogen effects. There is, as for other crops, a tissue test standard for nitrogen, which is 0.9 to 1.1%. We feel like some of these newer hybrids probably could go a bit higher and not be in a problem range, but the recommendation pretty much stands as being the sufficient range. And to achieve that, based on what you're taking out in a crop, so if you have a higher yielding hybrid, you tend to have more leaf mass. Some of those leaves fall by the wayside every year and are removed in the harvest operation. Between that and the fruit removal, there is a range of nitrogen removal and thus a range in what we recommend for application rates. Generally, they are applied in split applications two or three times during the season and are adjusted as the grower goes along based on visualization of how much growth, knowledge of what cultivar, previous year's tissue tests, because as with strawberries, we test in a period late in the season when the values are more stable, and that's kind of more of a report card on your annual use and not something that you can really correct in that season. And then any other factors that might have reduced your yield potential, like a pest infestation and so forth. For the most part, our growers are deciding on an N rate, and then they're carrying in K and P in some kind of a blended complete fertilizer. So with potassium, there hasn't been very much done recently, but back in the mostly in the 90s and earlier, there's some research that shows if you add K, tissue K goes up, but there was some surveyed grower data that showed with very high K applications, the yields were actually suppressed. In a study in Massachusetts, what we found was there was some response, but all the rates other than zero were statistically equivalent to one another. So some is good, more is not necessarily necessary, and there was a trend for reduced yield, even though this wasn't significant among those three rates. This is a study from Terrell Roper in Wisconsin on a sand bed, so something that's more like a newer construction where there's not a big peat underlayment. He looked at a series of rates. This experiment was designed to compare the chloride and sulfate forms of potassium, but he did have a rate range over two different years, and you can see that the two colors represent the 2 years. There were no statistically significant differences in yield among any of these rates or splits or forms, most likely due to the fact that in all cases, including zero, the yellow bar in the bottom graph represents the sufficiency level for potassium. So obviously they were not lacking. So our current recommendation varies anywhere from 40 to 120 kilograms. It really kind of depends on what blend the grower has chosen. We do look at soil tests, particularly in a young planting, to make sure, you know, in the very sandy situation, there is some in the soil. And we do look at the tissue test as well. Phosphorus is kind of the outlier. It's removed in the smallest amount of the big three that are in the fertilizer bag. Again, we're growing on acidic soils. Phosphorus is very tied up. Our Massachusetts cranberry beds are extremely high in iron and aluminum, and so that immobilizes the phosphorus. We very often will see a high soil test phosphorus, depending on what method is used, but often that's because it's stripping phosphorus off of these complexes that would not have been available to the plants. And so we depend on the tissue test mostly for phosphorus, and there we often see either low or sufficient paired with those super high soil values. So growers mainly are applying phosphorus based on the tissue test value and any need to increase that depending on what they've gotten for a test. So the question is, based on how little removal, how limiting is phosphorus fertilizer to yield? Well, this is an old study that I worked on, I think in the 80s, and similar to the potassium work, some was better than none, but all of these three rates in the study were equivalent statistically. They were all higher yielding than zero, but no different from one another. So based on this study, which was conducted over 3 years at 6 sites, probably the maximum recommendation would be for 20 pounds or about 22 kilos per hectare. Some more recent work about a decade later that was done both in Massachusetts by me and in Wisconsin by Tara Roper looked at a rate series of phosphorus supplied as triple superphosphate going from zero to about 34 kilograms per hectare over a long period of time. You can see in Wisconsin there were no yield differences. There were year-to-year differences, but no differences among the rates. Those lines are just following one another right along. But again, if you look at the tissue pea, it wasn't until 6 years in that the zero rate dropped below the sufficient level of 0.1%. In Massachusetts, we had a similar study, similar results in terms of yield. Again, great deal of year-to-year variability, but very little difference in response to fertilizer rate. And looking at a Bray soil test, all of the treatments over the whole time were in what we consider to be the sufficient range, although that's the best among not great choices for soil tests for cranberries. So we had this recommendation out there for the 22 kilograms per hectare being the most you needed, and there's a lot of environmental pressure on phosphorus with these inland water bodies. So the question became, you know, can we look at some reduced rates? So we recruited some growers to start reducing their rates of phosphorus, and we followed their yields over time. So this is a study that started in 2005, went through 2011, with people kind of dropping in and out of it. And each one of these points represents a year of yield on a commercial scale whole bed versus the amount of applied phosphorus that that grower used. And there is no significant relationship. That regression line is pretty much flat. And in fact, the cluster of the highest yielding beds are down there somewhere in the 5 to 10 kilograms per hectare applied rate. So this is intriguing, and certainly there's no evidence here that they're suffering in their crops. And so we're in a situation where we have a relatively modest recommendation, a soil test that isn't very, very good for our system, tissue phosphorus that can somewhat vary from year to year, experiments showing deficiency takes a long time to develop, and this yield curve showing no relationship. And so we have this 22 kilogram recommendation. Should it be lower? Well, why is that important? It's important, as I said, for these environmental considerations. These are some snapshots off of Google Earth showing some of these inland lakes in Massachusetts. We have the one on the right, the White Island Pond, actually is listed on our impaired waters list by the state, and it actually has a TMDL recommendation for it that has led to a set amount of phosphorus allowable set on those two cranberry beds. So you have the pond and those lands that are in the kind of medium color green that are at the north end of the pond there are cranberry bog systems that use that pond as a water source. The graphic on the left is the Monpont Pond. It's two lakes side by side. The West Lake is impaired and has toxic algal blooms every summer. And you can see, again, the lighter color green are cranberry bogs next to it. In this case, only the little tiny one up closest to the northern edge there actually puts water back into the pond. The rest of them drain in the other direction. But perception is reality to neighborhood groups that canoe along the pond and so forth and see this big set of cranberry bogs there and say that must be part of our problem. So we have these neighbor issues and these regulatory issues all around phosphorus enrichment in these bodies. And cranberry growers use a lot of water. I mean, there's a calculation that the annual use is somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 acre feet, which is about 30 million liters per hectare. That's a lot of water. About 40% of that comes from rain, and there is some recycling, and newer bed systems that have been either newly constructed or renovated and are more level have probably a lower requirement, but still, it's big. And what you see here is the traditional harvest picture with the berries floating. The picture in the middle is in the wintertime where water's put on to protect the vines from desiccation. That's frozen there. Growers then actually can use that frozen medium to go out and apply those layers of sand to anchor the stolons. And then there's also irrigation type use for adding water during the summer or for frost protection. But these floods are really the critical things. They're moving around vast amounts of water in these floods, often taking it from these lakes and then putting it back in. And so from 2003 to 2004, Brian Howes of UMass Dartmouth and I did a study looking at six different bog systems. We did a partial mass balance trying to calculate how much phosphorus, comparing what's coming in the water, what's going out in the water, and what the total net export was. And you can see we came up with a value of about 3.7 kilos per hectare, but it's pretty variable among the sites. But interestingly, this was much lower than what had been found in a study that Brian did with John Teal in the 90s with a bog configuration where there was a stream running through the bog. So a different land conformation gives us different export coefficients. So, okay, why are we not? There we go. So as I said, the floods are the big deal. When we did this partial mass balance, the big loads were in the floods. This is five sites that we followed during 2009 to 2012, looking at the milligrams per liter of phosphorus in the harvest flood just prior to discharge. And you can see the site label number one is the lowest. That site has implemented a reduced phosphorus fertilizer regimen for 10 years now. So they have the lowest amounts. And then the other sites are somewhat variable. Well, one thing that's really kind of bizarre, if you look at site number two, there's an up and down pattern. If you look at site number four, there's a huge spike in the most recent year in the data set. What's going on there? Because all of these sites have reduced their phosphorus by a certain amount and stayed at that amount over time. So you would expect that either they'd be like site number one, where we're pretty far in and it's low and stable, or they'd be declining over time. So that's one question that we had to ask ourselves. But just looking at that data, we can do some calculations of how much phosphorus would be released in those floods on an acre-foot basis during this harvest operation. And you can see it could be as much as 3.5 pounds per acre-foot. And if you figure the average flood, a harvest flood is probably more than an acre-foot deep, you can have some significant losses adding up over a large acreage of cranberry. Now, again, what's going on with this spike here, that big red bar sticking out there in the middle? Well, our relatively new ARS hydrologist, Casey Kennedy, who is now at our field station in Wareham, Massachusetts, has been looking. So these were partial mass balances because we were using mostly grab samples in this study. Casey has actually put out automated equipment to look at continuous monitoring during some floods. And what he's finding is, so this is a close-up of the edge of a cranberry bog at the bottom graphic there. There's the flume that allows the water to move in and out. There's a drainage ditch on the side, and you can kind of see where the surface of the bed is. So during harvest, the water is up over the top of the bed. As it's released, what Casey is finding is the phosphorus concentration is highest as the water level reaches just the surface of the bed and drops just below. Basically, you're draining out the water that was in contact with the soil. And so what we think is happening in our grab sample study is that sometimes we're grabbing too close to that spike, and we're getting an artificially high if it was integrated across the whole flood, and maybe other times we're getting earlier in the release and we're underestimating the release. So it kind of speaks to the idea, if you want a true picture, you have to integrate across the entire flood. Or time your grab samples so they're more representative of the dropping of the level. Something that also relates to this is that very early on in this kind of work, we got the idea, well, if you release the flood really quickly, you bring along a lot of debris and maybe a lot of particulate phosphors. So what if we very slowly release the flood using gravity over a period of time? That we wait a certain number of days to let everything settle, and then we start releasing slowly. So the arrow there represents letting it settle for a longer than normal period. The normal settling would be more like 2 or 3 days. We waited about 12. And what we found out is over time, all the various forms of phosphorus, particularly the phosphate, started spiking up. So what we think happens, and we confirmed with a laboratory experiment, is that by going this long of a time, we started to lose oxygenation in the soil water, and some of those bound phosphorus that were on iron compounds, as the iron changed redox state, that phosphorus was released into the flood. So again, so we have these chemical processes going on, and then we have potentially phosphorus that is being harbored in the soil water that might be being released with the flood. As I said, there are TMDL mandates. This is that White Island system again. And the arrow is showing the solution that one of, so these two sets of bogs that are up at the top here, the one to the left, that grower chose as a way to deal with the limitations on how much phosphorus they could put back into that lake. They took, and you can see on the left-hand side of the graphic, the arrow is pointing to a 16-acre cranberry bed that is now a holding pond. The grower sacrificed those 16 acres and turned that into a holding pond, as you can see in the right-hand picture. And so that grower just moves the water in and out of the holding pond and does not interact with the lake. The grower of the bogs on the right-hand side at the top of the lake is pumping back his water into the upland area. You can kind of see that white splotch up at the top there. That's an upland area where they're pumping the water back and land applying it and using the land as a phosphorus filter. And so those are, particularly the land application would not necessarily be a permitted activity, but this is all being done under a memorandum of understanding with the university, the Growers Association, the growers, the Department of Ag, the Department of Environmental Protection, basically to look at what kind of practices growers could use to take care of the situation. And you can also see that the White Island Pond is no longer as green as it used to be. The problem I have with this is that a bunch of other things happened at the same time that the growers changed their practice. The water level in the pond was manipulated so that it flushes better. They did some alum treatments to immobilize the sediments in the bottom of the pond, which were a huge source of phosphorus. And all of the homeowners in the area kind of really took on this idea that if everybody's part of the problem, everybody has to be part of the solution. So they're much more rigorous in their use of fertilizers and their how they care for their dirt roads and so forth. So everybody has done something, the pond has gotten better. So, you know, which part of the better we can assign to which activity is, it's not very scientific. It's not the way a scientist would want to run this, but you know, when you have this nasty green mess outside your house, you can understand why everybody's doing everything they can all at the same time. So, back to the idea of the simple approach. We had pretty good evidence that as we reduce phosphorus, we might be reducing the load in these floodwaters. So, we go back to looking at these long-term reductions, and we look at yield again, and what we find is our group that has the highest yield are doing better than they were pre-reduction and have all reduced in that 5 to 10 range. So that's similar to what I had shown before. And this is just showing it graphically. that, you know, there's no reduction in yield with the reduction in P. And again, here's our poster child, the 10-year site. And just to point out what a difference this can make, just the simple change in practice, if we look at year one, the calculated kilograms per hectare released in the harvest flood was around 3, about 1.75 in the winter flood, and after 10 years of reduction, it's down to 1 and 0.18. So just the change in fertilizer practice, without changing anything else that this grower was doing, changed that amount of loading coming off of his farm. So that particular farm, here's a graphic. The box shows the beds in question that interact with that Kettle Hole pond there. It's about 25 hectares. And so in 2003, that entire group of cranberry beds were releasing about 117 kilos. And 8 years later, it was down to 17, which is an 85% reduction based on our calculations. So what's next? So, you know, not every grower can take 16 acres and turn it into a holding pond or pump into an upland area. They might not have the land base. And so this is an experiment we're doing at that farm where I said there was only the one little 2-acre piece that interacted with the pond. That's the arrow at the top of the graphic showing the Google Earth map. So that 2-acre piece now has this concrete box next to it. The box has a drain at the bottom and is filled with sand. It's sand from on the farm that they normally use to sand the beds. And you can see they have put in a sump pump over there at the flume, and they're piping the water across and into this perforated pipe at the top of the filter. The water is draining through that filter bed and out through this black pipe at the bottom. We put up a carport over it so they wouldn't be filtering rainwater when it rains, and only the water from the bed. So this is our first attempt at a constructed sand filter. It just went in this spring in May. It's still a big learning process, but already we're starting to see some forming of flocculates on the surface. The sand is kind of high in iron. We're seeing some flocculates forming. Certainly the water looks a lot clearer when it comes out the pipe at the bottom of the filter than at the top, but we don't have the analytical results back. But this is the direction we're taking next. So just to wrap up a little bit on nitrogen, we're not as far down the road in terms of mitigation practices. We know a lot about nitrogen requirements. Again, this is unique to our coastal cranberry situation. So the phosphorus problem would be the same for cranberry growers in Wisconsin with their inland lakes. But this nitrogen is unique to coastal situations where nitrogen enrichment in the estuaries causes degradation. So our biggest concern is nitrogen movement in surface water. Cranberry beds are either built in areas with natural confining layers or they're constructed that way so they'll hold a flood. So we don't get a lot of leaching movement into the water table. It's mostly moving across the surface. It's mostly ammonium forms. That's the form we use. Our acid pH keeps it mainly in that form. And so we think the groundwater pathway is minor. What I've put up here is a Google Earth graphic of the town of Wareham, which is where I live. It's where our field station is. And you can see on this graphic the Wareham estuary, and then north of it, all of those kind of dark reddish-looking land blobs are cranberry bogs. This estuary has tons of cranberry acreage interacting with it. And so it's become a big issue around the town. I mean, this is a town that recently invested multiple millions of dollars to upgrade their sewage treatment plant because it was outputting nitrogen into one of the rivers that was going out to the estuary. It's a town where there are numerous neighborhoods where people are paying upwards of $30,000 a house in betterment fees to become sewered. So you can imagine that if they think it might be the cranberry bogs, they would be very happy to get out from under doing anything themselves. So it's become a really big issue. And the University of Massachusetts, Casey Kennedy from ARS, the Growers Association, we've all formed a partnership with a local nonprofit the Buzzards Bay Coalition, that estuary that goes into the Wareham River there is part of Buzzards Bay, which is in the elbow or the armpit, I guess, of Cape Cod, if you visualize Cape Cod sticking out. This is the graphic that says Buzzards Bay water quality is something put out by the coalition, and they rate all these different embayments. They have one of the longest-running, most rigorously scientific citizen monitoring programs in the country to monitor the health of Buzzards Bay. And you can see the Wareham Estuary has a lot of yellow and reds, which is poor water quality. So this is a very impaired body, and there are a lot of cranberries there. So we've partnered up with this group to go out and seek funding to figure out exactly what the impact of the cranberries are. Because as I tell all the citizens groups, if you misinterpret which land uses or which human activity is causing the problem and you address the wrong one, you're not going to get the result you're looking for in improved water quality. So this is data that's incident to that phosphorus study that I did with Brian House. We also analyzed for nitrogen, and if you look across the yellow bar at the bottom there, you can see that the output of nitrogen from those bogs was very variable, going anywhere from about 4 kilograms per hectare up to as high as 15. So there's a great deal of variability among these 6 sites. And if you compare that to, down at the bottom there, a flow-through bog at 22, the flow-through bog was the old Howes and Teal study. That was a very rigorous study, but of a type of bog that makes up less than 15% of all Massachusetts cranberries. It's what we call a flow-through bog. And this is what it looks like. There's a stream running right through the middle of the bog. You can see it here. It's becoming less and less popular because it's very hard to manage. You can't impound water when you apply pesticides. You have these nutrient issues. Some growers are addressing this by bypassing it and moving the stream around to the edge and making a bypass canal so it doesn't go through the production area. Others are reproducing what you see in the middle is an upland-style bog that's been created, and eventually they will abandon operations on the flow-through piece and allow it to become go back to being a natural wetland in order to deal with this issue. But the problem is that one study that was really rigorous is being used to model the land use for cranberries. And we feel like the number, just based on our incident data, is wrong. And it's Brian House's group that's in charge of the modeling. They know their number is too high, but they need a number to replace it with or to be able to assign specific numbers to specific bog configurations. And so that's what this partnership is trying to do, is look at different bog configurations, trying to figure out exactly, using continuous monitoring techniques, what the loads are from various ones so that we can model it. And if it turns out there's a moment in time, as with the phosphorus, where the concentrations are the highest, we would focus on those periods for potential mitigation treatments. And this just shows some of those other configurations. So the closed system in the center is like a completely made-from-scratch cranberry farm. They dug their own water supplies. They built the beds. Everything's a closed loop. But that's pretty rare. Probably no more than representative than the flow through. We have other ones that are where the water returns to the source that I mentioned. We have others that are so-called pass-through, so the water is released but not back to the same receiving body. It's maybe through a long channel through the woods and then eventually to another body. And so we're trying to characterize all of these. And that's where we're at. So as I said, these days I'm more of a water quality person than a plant nutrition person, but that's where it's at in cranberry production these days. Thank you.